Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event in cooperation with the Trust for Public Land and also the San Francisco Parks and Recreation Department. Speaking tonight is Will Rogers. He's the President and CEO of the Trust for Public Land, a national nonprofit that conserves land for people to enjoy as parks, playgrounds, community gardens, farms, historic places, and wilderness. Will is a nationally recognized advocate for land conservation and has given major addresses and interviews to the Urban Land Institute, the National Smart Growth Conference, the National Brownfields Conference, and the Talk of the Nation, among others. Welcome, Will Rogers, for tonight's talk.
Got the hammer. Thank you. Thank you, George. And I know it's really bad form to apologize when you're starting out, but a couple of apologies. First of all, this is not Trotsky's granddaughter speaking about addiction, nor is it Will Rogers' grandson speaking about cowboy humor and rope tricks. So if that's what you were expecting, you may have come to the wrong place. George informs me that this goes for an hour, and I certainly am not capable of speaking for an hour, so I'm going to rely on you all when it comes to Q&A to help out. I'm going to be talking some about history, but a lot about health and the value and the importance of parks and open space, and I suspect George has a better handle on some of the history than I do, although there's a wonderful book out now by a fellow named Alex Garvin, a planner and a former teacher at Yale, about the history of urban parks, which I really recommend. Alex Garvin, and it's terrific. In the context of speaking about parks, let's recognize that we're here in San Francisco. We are blessed to be in a city that has the remarkable park system that it does. We did, the Trust for Public Land last May published a study of the 40 largest cities in America. We looked at park access, you know, how many citizens are within a 10-minute walk of a local park or a garden. We looked at spending on parks. We looked at average park size, and we looked across 40 cities, and San Francisco came out number one. It was, head and shoulders above the others. I think something like 95 to 98% of the citizens are served by parks here in San Francisco, and also there's significant funds that are spent on parks and open space. So we're blessed to live in a remarkable place. Having said that, as we looked at the study, there were plenty of cities, and Fresno actually was at the bottom of the list. Charlotte was close by, who serve a relatively small portion of their population. Something like 40% of citizens actually have access to parks and open space. So there's a huge divergence in terms of access to the health benefits that we get out of parks and open space. So the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, has something called the Red List. And in the Red List, they track about 60,000 species and species health and species extinction. And that list goes, the categories go from of no concern, meaning, hey, the species is fine, to extinct, which is not so fine, and goes through of concern, threatened, endangered, extinct in the wild, and ultimately extinct. It's probably of no surprise to a lot of people that habitat is one of the single biggest factors in species health and species extinction, either the lack of habitat or degraded habitat, and probably not a surprise to people that human activity has an awful lot to do with that degradation of habitat. We're not on the list. We humans are actually not on the Red List. And I wonder if we were on the list where we would come out. Would we be of no concern? There are 7 billion of us, so we're not running out of people anytime soon. But if you look at species health and the health of our species, we've got about 1 billion of us who are either hungry or malnourished. We have a surprising number who are on the other side of the coin, obese, and in the developed nations, that is growing at epidemic rate. A third of people in the United States are now obese, and that's happening internationally, so we're not unique in that regard. We have heart disease, asthma, hypertension, stress, a whole host of other health issues associated with our own habitat. So by many measures, we are also a species in trouble. And I submit that our habitat has a lot to do with it. This isn't a new idea. Dr. Dick Jackson, formerly of the CDC in Atlanta, and now at UCLA, has written a number of books and recently did a four-part PBS series on designing healthy communities. And he points out that the way that we've been building our communities, and he looks particularly at our suburbs, for example, where we separate land uses. You have to travel to get anywhere. There are no sidewalks. There are no bike paths. You have to drive past wall-to-wall fast food outlets to get there. Is not exactly the healthiest way that we could be creating our habitat. And yet we are the only species that can truly shape and control the world around us. So it would seem that we have bungled the job. And I was thinking, it being a philosophical discussion, I was thinking about, let's go back to where we evolved. Let's put ourselves back in the African savanna 300,000 years ago, roughly, when Homo sapiens really emerged. And imagine that environment for which we're designed. It was really only an evolutionary moment ago. We're still effectively the same species that came out of the savanna. Think big acacia trees, grass fields, woods. Preying on animals. Think about being preyed on by animals. We got a lot of exercise back in the day, running away from things bigger than we were with large teeth. Our diets were diverse. I'm not romanticizing that. Certainly we don't want to go back there. It isn't exactly a lifestyle that any of us would choose. Lives were rather short and pretty scary. But if you then look at the flip side of what we're creating today, and just last week in Beijing, I think the micrograms per cubic meter was at 1,000. A really horrible day in Los Angeles is 100. They pulled people in off the street. It was so hazardous. And that's effectively a habitat choice. And I'm not talking about, high-rise living or transportation, but I'm talking about, how we manage our energy, how we manage our lives, how we manage our human settlements. And that's one example. And I mentioned earlier what Dick Jackson writes about our suburbs. There are a lot of mistakes that we've made in laying out our habitat. And it's really a series of small design errors that when you add them all together have given us what we have today, which is really not working for our species. And I'd argue when you look at climate impacts and you look at the extinction of other species, it's really not working for the rest of the planet either. When I talk about habitat, I'm obviously not just talking about parks and our connection with nature, which is going to be the main source of my comments. But I'm also talking about transportation, energy use, political structure, where we choose to live, the size of our settlements, density of our cities, a whole host of other issues. And the solutions, I would argue, have to be absolutely as holistic as they possibly can be. But being a parks person, and loving the outdoors, and working for an organization that is committed to connecting people with nature, I'm really going to focus on one aspect of our habitat that we haven't gotten right. Got it a lot righter here in San Francisco than we have in a lot of other parts of the planet. And think a little bit about what the benefits are of investing in parks and in open space from a health standpoint, health in the largest sense. Also what some of the needs are, the challenges of getting there, and some of the opportunities that I'm seeing. I've come to think about parks and open space and green playgrounds and trails and greenways as a kind of a health plan in this time when we've been talking a lot about health plans, but health in the biggest sense of the word. Our physical and our mental health, the health of our communities, the health of our environment, and the health of our economies. I mentioned some of the challenges that we're facing with obesity right now, with a third of us obese. I think we're spending something like $200 billion a year on treating type 2 diabetes right now in this country. It's going like that. Dick Jackson points out that medicine only makes things worse. Lifestyle change is the only thing, diet and exercise, that really addresses this. Medicine allows us to keep sick people alive for longer. And so it just becomes an even greater cost. So it really is very much about lifestyle change. And to have that change, you have to have the opportunities. And more, we're seeing that if you build it, they will come. We're seeing it with trails and greenways, fitness zones, which we built. We, the Trust for Public Land, have built 40 of them in Los Angeles. They're really outdoor exercise areas, indestructible health club type equipment, where people can go and work on machines. And the RAND Corporation did a study, and people show up day after day, the same people, and oftentimes they're overweight people that really need to do it. And they're a very cost-effective way of delivering health. Trails and greenways are getting an unprecedented amount of use in this country for bikers, for hikers, for walkers. And in study after study, you can demonstrate that if people have close-to-home access to these assets, if you will, they're going to use them. So there's real benefit to our physical health, and I won't even go into the opportunities presented by community gardens, local food production, using some of our land. I don't think we're going to solve our urban food problem within the city limits, but if we can demonstrate to our communities what healthy local food looks like, it really helps them make better choices. So there are a number of ways in which how we use our land and parks and open space and gardens really benefit our physical health. On the mental side, I'm a strong believer in the biophilia principle. E.O. Wilson, a number of other people at Yale have done a lot of work on this. The premise is that we have an innate need to connect with nature and with other species. And again, there are a lot of studies that show that when you're in the hospital, if you have a view of a parking lot rather than a park, you're going to be there longer. People, even a photograph on the wall of a natural scene, people heal more quickly. They've done studies in green buildings where people have natural light, more fresh air. Absenteeism is lower. Turnover is lower. People are happier. The morale is better. Even Walmart did a study of natural light versus artificial light and demonstrated, and they were keeping this a secret. They thought it was competitive advantage, perhaps, that people like natural light better. All things being equal, they spent more time and spent more money under a skylight than under a lighting fixture. So again, our mental health, not to mention the respite, the peace, the change of scene that we need in cities, given the hubbub and the noise and the tension that parks provide. On the community health standpoint, the public realm really gives us a place where we can come together, and I would argue that now more than ever, we need ways to come together as a society. We're getting so fractious, and the oppositional politics are so difficult. One of my solutions is a whole lot more sidewalk cafes, and let's sit down and actually talk things through. But parks and open space give people an opportunity to come together as community, as neighborhoods, and engage. And if you can have gardening and playgrounds so that you get gardeners and parents and families and places where communities can gather, you're really adding an enormous benefit to local neighborhoods. The other way that parks and open space and playgrounds can build community is the actual act of creating those green assets. We at the Trust for Public Land use something called participatory design in pretty much everything that we do in cities, which means we get together with the communities, often with school children, sit down with them, our landscape architects sit down, and really listen to what they want. And it's an iterative process going back and forth with the community to make sure that what comes out at the end of the day is very much what they want and they need, and they have an enormous amount of influence. A couple of things happen when you do that. If you take the time, and it does take time, and it's a lot more process, but people get very engaged, they develop a sense of ownership, and at the end of the day, they're much better stewards, and they care a whole lot more about taking care of that playground or taking care of that park. And we've found time and again that if you could wave a wand and put in a new park and create it from scratch without engagement, it just wouldn't serve us and wouldn't serve the communities that we work with. The other thing that happens with communities when they get involved in these kinds of activities is that they develop a sense that they can actually make something happen. And creating a playground or creating a green schoolyard or a new park is a whole lot easier, frankly, than tackling some of the other challenges that communities have to tackle. So if you can cut your teeth on something easier and create the relationships with City Hall and with other communities, you can use those skills and go on and actually have some impact on some bigger challenges in your community. So that's another way that it builds community. So that's individual health and that's community health. On the environmental health standpoint, that would seem to be pretty obvious. Well, parks, of course, they're going to help the environment. And we know, you know, we have the heat island effect, having trees and grass and open space absolutely lowers temperatures, lowers the need for energy costs, and in turn helps deal with pollution. Trees filter our air, wetlands and filter our water. So the environmental services, we're beginning to quantify them, but they are absolutely enormous. And we're getting down to the point now where we know the contributory value of a street tree over the course of its life. So that's one area that we're getting good environmental services. Another one is around climate, or there's several around climate. One is in dealing with carbon. Obviously, you know, trees soak up carbon. There's a lot of sequestration that goes on. We're also, when we're doing trails and greenways, providing alternative modes of transportation. More and more people are, bike riding is an epidemic in this country right now. It's a really exciting one, too. And we're seeing an enormous amount of usage of urban trails and greenways around the country. But walking and hiking, people are getting out, and they're actually not just doing it for exercise, but also doing it to get from point A to point B. And that's, again, lowering demand for fossil fuel burning transportation, and on the margin is providing some assistance. A really interesting new environmental benefit that we're seeing, particularly post Hurricane Sandy, and again, remember that before Sandy, there was massive amounts of climate denial going on across the country, and then when all of a sudden you have Governors Christie and Cuomo and Mayor Bloomberg coming out and saying, hey, this thing is real and we've got to do something about it. The dialogue has changed significantly. And one thing that, there are two things, frankly, that parks and open space can do to really help in this regard with severe weather. One is with stormwater runoff. We call it green infrastructure. But the earth is a sponge, and it soaks up rainwater appropriately, gets it down to the water table ultimately. A lot of our cities are pretty impervious, and a lot of it runs off. And you can actually design playgrounds, parks, open space to be real sponges, to do a whole lot more than they would normally do. And by doing that, you can impound a lot of water in these significant storms. You know, we're having 100-year storms about every year these days. And so the issue of runoff going into sewers and then having a combined sewer overflow, which pollutes our bays, pollutes our rivers, puts people in deep trouble in the Clean Water Act and gets them really steep fines with the EPA, people are saying, okay, what can we do about this? And there's gray infrastructure solutions, underground storage tanks, deep tunnels like Chicago did, but there are also green infrastructure solutions. The way in which we design and build our playgrounds, our parks, our open space are all ways that we can begin to deal with stormwater runoff and capture a lot of it and get it back down into the water table, or at least slow it down so it doesn't overflow the sewers. The other benefit we get out of green infrastructure is in storm surge. And we saw after Sandy, Trust for Public Land has done a ton of work around Barnegat Bay in New Jersey. And we looked at the maps of where the destruction was greatest. And you could see where tidal areas, where coastal areas had been protected and gone into open space rather than been developed, the area around those and behind them suffered much, much less damage than those areas where people built right up to the coast, and you didn't have that buffer area. And whether it's in New Jersey or on the edge of New Orleans, there are a lot of places where there are still wetlands that could be preserved and not filled and act as storm surge buffers. So there are a lot of environmental benefits coming out of investments in parks and open space. And then the final piece of the four-part health plan is around our economies. The items I've mentioned already, for example, the health benefits, the green infrastructure benefits, have real dollar and cents value when we're talking about contributory value and really helping to solve a problem. But there are a couple of other things that cities recognize when they're investing in parks and open space. One is around the drawing power of iconic signature parks. I don't know how many people have been to Millennium Park in Chicago. How about the High Line in New York? You know, extraordinary signature parks, wonderful investments. You know, I think of the the sort of trajectory of our rediscovery of urban parks in this country as kind of a three-part saga. The first is our classic Olmsted-type parks and the effort that we've made, whether it's the Central Park Conservancy or Piedmont Park in Atlanta, et cetera, to refurbish and refix our classic gems. And we've done a great job in doing that. The next phase has been around signature parks and those iconic parks that really are a draw. And I would say Millennium Park and the High Line are really two great examples of that. The phase that most excites me about where we're going with parks and open space is really the focus on the park system. And it's the park system here in San Francisco, frankly, that got such high marks for this city. And it's recognizing that it isn't just about the Olmsted parks, and it's not just about the High Lines, but it's also about neighborhood parks and connecting people with nature close to home. But those signature parks do have economic value to cities. And if you looked at the preliminary predictions about what was going to happen in the wake of Millennium Park, and that was a $200 million investment. It was put on top of they basically decked the parking. You weren't allowed to build structures, so all they did was put a park over train tracks and parking. Then they bonded against the parking revenues to help pay for half the park, and then philanthropy paid for the other half, including the Frank Gehry band shell and the bean, I forget, what Cloud Gate or whatever it's called, the Kapoor sculpture that's so wonderful. But the outcome after the fact in terms of additional development in the neighborhood, rents, tourism, et cetera, is absolutely off the charts. When you looked at the numbers beforehand, you said, what have these people been smoking? There's no way this thing's going to generate this kind of revenue. And after the fact, it exceeded everyone's expectations. So there's real economic benefit in drawing people in on the tourism side, on property taxes, et cetera. But the other benefit that we're seeing in investment, particularly in park systems, is that cities are competing with each other. They are, Dallas is competing with Chicago, and Dallas competed with Chicago to get Boeing. Boeing chose Chicago. And what they said is, we like the quality of life in Chicago. And that was a wake-up call for Dallas. And Dallas always thought, hey, if you're a good place for business, that's what counts. And since then, Dallas has put in a huge amount of money into its cultural district. It is creating a park along the Trinity River, which used to be basically a sewer that ran next to Dallas. They now have one Calatrava bridge, another one under construction, spanning the river. They hope to have a sense of place and something to put on their postcards. They've decked over a freeway connecting the downtown with the neighborhood immediately to the north. And it's absolutely amazing to see. They're turning downtown parking lots into parks. And they get it. They competed and they lost. And you see cities around the country, and who are they competing for? They're competing for businesses, but they're also competing for the young, educated, mobile workforce that can choose where it wants to live. And those people choose wonderful cities. They choose cities that are green, livable, walkable, with great culture, dynamic retail, and that have great neighborhoods. And so more and more, the good news is that we're seeing cities make these investments because they know it's in their best interest. So let me talk a little bit about the need and what we see out there, and then some challenges and opportunities. I mentioned this study we did last May called Park Score. 40 largest cities in America looking at access, looking at investment in parks, looking at average park size. It's a sophisticated tool, but it's still crude in terms of what you'd really like to be able to do. Because I can tell you that San Francisco came out on top on the one hand. On the other hand, we're in the process of working with the city right now on Bodecker Park in the Tenderloin. We did the Hayes Valley Playground. And both of those places showed up on the map as parks. But when you went there, they just weren't functional. So there's a quality aspect that's really hard to grasp, and in the future we're going to try to figure out how to work that into our own analytics. So even a city that has as great a system as San Francisco, if you went into Bodecker Park, it just didn't function. People were scared there. It didn't work for the neighborhood. In a year's time, go back, and it's going to be entirely different, right? Absolutely. So I think you have to both understand access, but you also have to understand the quality of what's there. So the need is significant. The need for trails and greenways is huge. Again, I said there's an epidemic out there, a wonderful epidemic of you know, walking, running, and biking. Cities need a whole lot more of that work. The High Line is great as far as it goes, but you can't take a bicycle up there and you can't take pets up there. It's a little too narrow, a little too short. Chicago is doing a three-mile Bloomingdale Trail, an elevated High Line there that will be an east-west bike connector for a major route that goes along the lake and gets people into downtown. And it also goes through three or four different neighborhoods that are incredibly underparked. And those kinds of trails always provide you with opportunities to do access parks along the trails. So not only do you get the benefit of the trail, as you do in the Bloomingdale in Chicago, or we're working on one in Atlanta called the Beltline. Thank you, Tim. Where there are going to be a whole, it's like an emerald necklace, and there are going to be a whole series of new parks along this 22-mile, mostly abandoned rail corridor. There's a huge need for more trails, more greenways, more opportunities for people to get out and walk and exercise. I would say the same is true with fitness zones, particularly in low-income neighborhoods where people don't have the wherewithal to belong to health clubs, but where exercise is absolutely critical. And if you can put those fitness zones next to playgrounds so that parents can watch their kids playing and their kids can watch their parents exercising, then you're really accomplishing something more. And I was talking the other day to someone from Los Angeles, from the health department in Los Angeles, who was out looking at fitness zones that we'd done, and said that he went out a couple of times and noticed that not only are people using the equipment, but the same people are showing up and they're building community. And they're starting to say, oh, yeah, you're here. I was here the other day. I also go walking. You want to walk together? And there is some social capital being built around these assets because people are using them on a regular basis. So that's another need. How do you give people a better chance to exercise wherever possible? Let me talk a little bit about the challenges and then about some of the things that excite me about what's happening to those challenges. Money is always a challenge. This is one, you know, if we think about how we're going to fix our human habitat, this is one element. There are so many different things that we have to do, and there are competing needs. To the extent that parks and open space can solve multiple needs, it moves up the hierarchy of priorities. There's a great professor at Texas A&M by the name of John Crompton, who specializes in sort of in parks and recreation and marketing and use, who points out that some of the early park work done, get a little history here, some of the early park work done in the late 19th century was really, and if you read some of what Olmsted said about parks being great democratizers, you know, we're in the late industrial revolution, you know, cities, there was a lot of disease, the air was not clean. Parks were seen as essentially as a health plan back then, to deal with the incredible pollution they were facing and to give people who lived in very poor people who lived in very dense neighborhoods an opportunity to get out and mingle and do something healthy on the weekends or their one day off or their 1 hour off or however much time they got. And I would say it's come back around again because those investments were made not just because parks are a good thing, and I bet a lot of us in this room think parks, we should invest in parks simply because they're good in and of themselves and we need that connection with nature. But if you can also have them solve problems for you, they move up the list of priorities. And so to the extent that parks are making cities competitive and they're solving health problems and they're beginning to address climate issues, all of a sudden they become more competitive and you can draw more resources in. You're looking at infrastructure money as opposed to simply parks money. So when you can get, you know, EPA funding or other money from water districts and sewer districts, then you're able, the pie suddenly starts getting bigger. But funding is a real challenge. Land is a challenge. Now, with the exception of Detroit, Cleveland, Flint, and a lot of the auto communities where they have too much land and, frankly, too many vacant houses that need to be scraped, most cities aren't in that situation. San Francisco certainly isn't. New York certainly isn't. When we did the analysis for Mayor Bloomberg as part of his Plan YC, to see how many New York residents lived within a half mile or a 10-minute walk of a park or a playground, a lot of neighborhoods came up short. And they said, well, you know, go out and find places to put parks. And we went out, and there wasn't any place to do it. There were parking lots, but that was it. And we ended up working in school playgrounds. And we found large school playgrounds in neighborhoods where they didn't otherwise have parks. And the playgrounds were mostly, there were cars parked on them, busted up asphalt, chain link fence, maybe a basketball hoop, probably not. And so the opportunity to work with kids and actually create a playground that then the neighborhood could use after hours, on the weekends, in the summer, effectively provided parks in areas where there was no land to otherwise do it. So you've got to get creative, and to the extent that cities can get sort of dual-use agreements between the Parks Department and the Department of Education, that's incredibly valuable, and it's happening in more and more places. But land is a problem, and that's one of the solutions, and I have a few more in just a sec. I think awareness is an issue. I think too few people are really aware of the contributory value of making these investments. The cities that are doing them and leading in this regard absolutely get it, but there's still a long ways to go. That's one of the reasons that we did ParkScore, was to give a wake-up call to mayors and parks departments as to where their shortcomings were. And we have a lot of people that are now saying, okay, how do we get our score up? And which is great. That's exactly what we want, because they need to be thinking about trying to improve the services that they're providing with their communities. Other solutions that we're seeing, I think, that are really exciting for us. I talked about the elevated rail lines. There's one in Queens that we're working on right now, similar to the Bloomingdale Trail called the Queensway. But there are a lot of rail trail opportunities around the country. There's one on the east side in Seattle, a 40-mile rail opportunity, the east side corridor, that's incredibly exciting. And the communities all along that corridor are excited, and that's a real biking community. So we see, again, rail trail conversions provide a lot of opportunities. School playgrounds, as I mentioned, decking over freeways. You can't work in a city or close into a city without running into contaminated soil. That's just the nature of the beast. And so the solutions invariably have to recognize that you're going to have to work with environmental degradation and figure out how to clean it up and do it. But we crossed that bridge a long time ago, and so far so good in that regard. Our board wasn't too excited about that at the beginning, but they've gotten used to it. On the funding side, in addition to sort of making the pie bigger through finding other opportunities and engaging other sources of revenue or funding like sewer departments, et cetera, one thing that, and I was asked the other day, what keeps me up most at night these days? And it actually doesn't have anything to do with the Trust for Public Land. It has to do with the political stalemate that we have going on in this country right now. It just drives me crazy. And we have a strong Washington office, and we do a lot of work there, and I avoid it as much as I can. It's not a happy place to be. And the great irony is that this issue around parks and open space and protecting the places that we care about completely cuts through everything. And we have done probably $35 or more billion worth of voter-approved bond, sales tax, real estate transfer tax initiatives since the mid-90s. And we're arguably the national experts in doing this work. And we have done them in the most conservative communities in the interior West. We've done them with every county in New Jersey and everything in between. So red state, blue collar, white collar, young, old, people come together around this issue. And we saw it in November here in San Francisco, you know, almost $200 million for our park system because the people in this city really care. But that isn't just the progressives. I mean, you see that across the country. So there are real opportunities to go to the people, and if you show them what you want to do, and you don't say, oh, trust us, we'll spend it wisely, but you have a list of what you're going to do with the money, there are real genuine opportunities to generate public funding. And then the philanthropic support for this, because of the problems that parks are helping to solve, is also going up. So there is some good news around the funding side. I'm going to stop there and take Q&A. I'm really optimistic about where we are right now. I mean, I think we are in deep trouble as a species. We have really screwed things up in many ways. But place by place, community by community, neighborhood by neighborhood, at least in the field that I'm working in with my fellow folks at the Trust for Public Land, we're seeing real positive opportunities where people are getting traction and where community passion around this is able to make a difference. And so I am optimistic that this piece of our habitat, that we can begin to get it right and repattern things. And I think ultimately it's going to take that. There's 7 billion of us now. There are going to be some number of billions more. If we don't get it right now, when are we going to get it right? But again, the solutions oftentimes tend to be local solutions, and that's what excites me, because I'm seeing a lot of action going on locally. So I'm going to end with, they say, oh, you know, end with a quote. Well, I'm going to end with, you know, four or five quotes. But these are quotes that have meaning to me in the work that I do. One is from former Seattle Mayor James T. Rowland, speaking in the late 1880s, and he said, "Parks are the beating hearts and breathing lungs of all great cities, and from them come whispers of peace and joy." This next one's from Robert Michael Pyle in a book called The Thunder Tree, and he was really talking about how you can't want to protect nature if you don't know it. And he writes, "Those who care conserve. Those who don't know don't care. What's the extinction of the condor to a child who has never known a wren?" And then I'll paraphrase Aldo Leopold's land ethic. And it used to be at the Trust for Public Land that when anyone new would come to work for the organization, they would be given a copy of the Sand County Almanac by Huey Johnson. Probably should get that going again, because the land ethic is at the core, in a sense, of what we do and what we stand for. And I'm paraphrasing it. These aren't his words. But when he talked about the land ethic, he was really saying, land is not a commodity to be exploited, but rather a community of which we and all of our fellow species are members. And then two final quotes by my namesake, Will Rogers. "Even if you're on the right track, you'll get run over if you just sit there." And then finally, "Never miss a good opportunity to shut up." So, George.
Well, I'm afraid, Will, we're not going to let you shut up yet, because there'll be a lot of questions. But I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that listening to Will Rogers, the president of the Trust for Public Lands, speaking about the value of parks in our communities, in our cities. So, who would like to ask the first question?
I was wondering if there's been any study correlating the monetary cost of crime in a community and relating it to the absence of parks. You see what I'm saying?
I do. I absolutely see what you're saying. It's really difficult. There are a number of different things that we believe as an article of faith to be the case. Crime reduction is one. The direct correlation between obesity and the presence or absence of parks is another. The problem is there's so many different factors that play into that that it's very hard to come up with a study that absolutely identifies that. Again, there are lots of anecdotes, and one of my favorites was back when in the Rodney King, you know, depending on what you call it, the disturbance or the revolution or whatever happened in Los Angeles, there was an enormous amount of destruction. The playgrounds and the parks and the community gardens weren't touched. People were out there protecting those neighborhood assets. So that connection is absolutely huge. But to be able to say, you know, how you would capture that in a study would be very difficult. There are a number of studies about midnight basketball, for example, programs, you know, programming within parks, which I think is really important. You can have a park. I mean, we have Bodecker Park, but it desperately needs to be fixed up, and it needs new programming, and it needs better safety. It needs eyes on the street. It needs design that really makes sense, all of which is happening. It'd be interesting to do a before and after on that one to see if you could get a correlation, but I'm not sure that it would be statistically reliable. So there are all kinds of stories out there that say, yes, actually it does make a difference if you have local opportunities, after-school programs in particular, but good programming in parks, athletics, et cetera, that reduce crime. but none that I can say categorically point to that one.
You mentioned Frederick Law Olmsted, and thinking about what I understand to be his philosophy, and you can correct me if I'm wrong by all means, but that we hear this from the other side of the aisle too, that the founders intended that this be a democracy and that his intention was to create for the people parkland equivalent to the estates of kings and queens and lords and ladies and such like that. And in your talk today, I don't hear a current philosophy like that. I mean, it's all sort of dollars and cents. We can save so many lives or extend life or reduce crime. Is there any place for that sort of larger, lofty ideal of, you know, America for the people?
Shame on me. I mean, to some extent, I take that for granted, but it's a point really well taken, and I think a lot of us who work in this take it for granted. That's why we're here. That's why we're doing this, because we love nature. We love that connection. We believe that, you know, we have a national standard that everyone should be within a 10-minute walk or a half mile of a park. You know, frankly, I think kids that aren't, they're the endangered species. And so, absolutely, we tend, I think, particularly in this economy at this time, to sort of get caught up in the arguments that we make for people who don't get it. But I suspect that many in this people in this room do get it. I think there's an inherent value, and again, I mentioned the biophilia hypothesis, in being able to make that connection and make that connection close to home. And, you know, I think those of us who do this work do it because we value that connection and we want that for others. We have a new a fellow who just came onto our board by the name of Ron Sims. Ron was the executive for King County, which is the county where Seattle sits. And then most recently he was undersecretary of housing under Sean Donovan. And Ron is African American. He grew up in a very poor neighborhood. And he talks about his upbringing. They didn't have any parks in his neighborhood. And he loves salmon. I mean, he was this county executive who was all over conservation, environment, et cetera. And a lot of people from his own community said, you know, how come you love salmon so much? You know, what's the deal, Ron? He said, you know, growing up, we had no parks. And I regard this as a basic fundamental human right. And the fact that we didn't have it really makes me want to get it for everyone else. And so I think it is a very important right. I think Olmsted got it right. I think we all believe that, and that's really why I think it's so important to focus not just on the High Lines and the Millennium Parks and, you know, and the Golden Gate Parks, which are wonderful, but also on neighborhood parks and community assets, particularly in low-income neighborhoods. But thank you for calling me on that.
Goes back to this, if you're selling something now, you want to persuade people you use the materialistic arguments, but that actually the bigger arguments that stand behind it are more powerful in the long run, but it's not as high.
I'm next week going to be giving a keynote at the Outdoor Industry Association, the sort of North Faces and the Patagonias, et cetera, have an annual meeting, and they're meeting in Salt Lake City next week, and you know that everyone who's in that industry, or a huge number of those people, are there because they're passionate about the outdoors. And yet what they want to talk about is they want to talk about how to make the economic argument to Congress and others to get funding to allow that to happen. And so you have this sort of underlying connection that everyone shares on the one hand, and we're talking about something else. And it's an odd situation that we're in. I can hear you.
Thank you very much for coming here tonight. So continuing this economic debate and making the most of it, you talked about finding funding through other opportunities like sewer, water, and EPA. You also talked a lot about the health benefits of better planning and urban parks. What is the trust doing to
So the 40 fitness zones that we've done in Los Angeles, and we're starting to do other parts of the country, about half of those were funded by Kaiser Permanente. And they're now funding fitness zones in counties, demonstration fitness zones in counties in Southern California, but we're also talking to them in other parts of the country. The R.W. Johnson Foundation has, you know, they got this early on. The Colorado Health Foundation, United Health, there are a number of folks that we're talking to who get that if they don't solve this obesity problem, they're going out of business. The country's going to go out of business. And so they're desperate to find solutions, and they see this as one possible way of dealing with the problem. They recognize that if you create these things, people are going to use them. And so, so far, they're very excited about what they're seeing. So we're working very closely with, certainly with healthcare providers and with foundations that have a focus on health. And increasingly, we're talking to health departments because it's this interesting overlap between parks departments and health departments. And parks officials care a lot about this stuff, but it's an interesting coming together of two separate governmental entities, which is, I think, very healthy.
Hi. Oh, now it works. There we go. You make some really great points about how, you know, everybody in this room, and I think a lot of people who'd be listening to you right now, agree that parks and open spaces are a vital and important part, and everybody should have access to them. And as the face of America is changing and not looking like this room for very much longer, becoming much more multicultural, I'm just curious what you think the space for parks and open spaces is in making just these places more relevant and culturally appropriate, and what that looks like to you.
A couple of things here. There was, an urban myth or whatever you call it a while back that the Hispanic community didn't care as much about parks as the Anglo community. And we've seen in California, in a couple of the statewide bond measures, they outvoted the Anglos by a significant margin. So there's absolutely no question that this passion and this connection, you know, cuts across racial lines and ethnic lines. And what I think is interesting, embedded in your question, is different cultures have different needs. And how you design parks has a lot to do with whether those parks are going to be relevant or not. And so the idea that a park is that way forever, or even is in that place forever, is a challenging idea. Certainly, as communities change, as you get an influx of people from a different ethnic or national background, the needs change. You might go from, you know, soccer fields to, you know, to picnic areas and movable seating, or we're seeing neighborhoods spring up in industrial areas that were never designed to be inhabited that desperately need parks. And we're seeing this in the downtowns of a lot of cities where it was pretty much strictly office or industrial, and now there's a lot of residential. The Twin Cities is a great example. Minneapolis wasn't included in our study because it wasn't big enough. We're doing the 50 largest cities next year. Minneapolis could bump San Francisco. It'll be interesting to see. But what's interesting about Minneapolis is the surrounding area around the city is incredibly well-parked, and they have the lakes and the trails. It's, I think, now the most bike-friendly city in America. It beat out Portland. But the downtown ain't. It's got a lot of former industrial, a lot of mills along the Mississippi River, a lot of commercial, a lot of parking lots, and it's the hole in the donut. So there are a lot of cities where the downtown was never designed to really be inhabited. And how you shape those parks has a whole lot to do with who's living there. And who's living there now may be very different from who's living there in 20 years. And so you have to be able to move with the users. It makes it fun.
I agree with your comments that San Francisco has a very good park system. And I was wondering if you could comment on the situation that happened at the last election. You referred to the bond issue that overwhelmingly was approved. But in my understanding, it looked like there were some organizations that typically support parks and neighborhood groups that were opposed to the bond issue. And I guess they were using it as a pawn because they didn't like some of the policies of San Francisco Rec and Park, like putting in artificial turf in part of Golden Gate Park and privatization. And it just seemed very odd to me that they almost were using the bond issue as a hostage, trying to get the Parks Department to change their policies.
I won't comment on that, but it seemed odd to me, too.
That was the most detailed no comment comment I've heard in a while. Who's next? Any other questions? We have time for a couple more. Great.
Will, you cited studies that give a kind of formula that cities need a certain amount of open space. That I want to couch this in terms of density, a related issue to what you're doing. So obviously, you've got some data, some studies, plenty of studies that show the desirability of open space per population. And I wonder if there's also, if you know of any studies that do the opposite. Does a park require a certain population of people in order for it to be healthy?
I don't know of any studies that looks at that, but I do know that there are parks, you're a designer, you know that there are parks, if you don't design it right, you can have a park that isn't safe and doesn't work. And there was certainly a time with some of our public housing where you had, I lived in Chicago for a while and you had Cabrini Green that was Cabrini Scary, and you essentially had, high-rise residential towers surrounded by green, but the green was essentially a no-man's land. And so they didn't function at all, and I think that was essentially a design problem, both the idea that that's how we should handle affordable housing in the first place, and second place, that somehow people would want to use that as a park. I don't know the answer to that. I do know that if we don't figure out as a nation how to live more densely, and this gets into the sprawl versus urban densification issue, we're in real trouble. I mean, we're going to keep growing. We're going to have another couple hundred million people. What are we going to do with them? And, people who complain about density, I live in Berkeley, and it's the most progressive, conservative community that I've ever been in. the idea of sort of densification is scary to people. They want it to happen someplace else, and yet we're going to have to figure out how to do that. And how we invite nature into density and get a balance and a cooperation between the two, I think will make an enormous difference in terms of how livable that density is. Paris is a pretty dense city, but it's, who doesn't like Paris? And they with the boulevards and the parks, they've managed to do, a wonderful job. I think we can do the same, and I think for a lot of people who are afraid of density, I think how we manage nature in the cities and how we use design is going to have to get us more comfortable with that solution.
Hi. My question is, in the next 20 or 30 years, what sort of skill sets do you think your organization and that this, the public land movement will need? It sounds like natural resource economists would be the first on the list, but do you need planners or environmental engineers? Just trying to understand.
Yeah, I think all of above. I'm eminently qualified to do what I'm doing. I was a drama major as an undergraduate. And a beekeeper at one point. I think there's always room for mavericks in this work. But I think people who really understand planning, who understand design, who understand negotiation and transactions. The challenge is for an organization that works from Main Street to mountaintop across that full spectrum. And I've been talking about our work in cities here, but we do a lot of work outside the city limits. And the skill sets that you use in a city are somewhat different than the skill sets that you use outside the city. Some of them are the same, some of them are different. It's a whole lot more complex in terms of engagement. And I think sort of knowing how to deal with people, how to work a collaborative process, how to get public participation going, how to do participatory design becomes more and more important when you have such diverse communities coming together around an asset that you're trying to make happen. So. I think the ability to work well with people is always going to be critical. And, 20 years, who knows what we're going to be doing in 20 years and what we're going to be confronting. We're certainly, as an organization, a lot different than we were 20 years ago.
One other question about the organization. How many employees are there, and what's the source of your major source of your funding? Is it private?
We have about 350 employees and about 35 offices around the country, which – is pretty dispersed, but the work that we do is very local, so we need to be out there. And our support is philanthropic support, from foundations, individuals. We have a wonderful cadre of volunteers. We have state advisory boards and a national board, people that give us, networking and reach and their support. And then we get a certain amount of support from the landowners with whom we work. There are landowners who will say, I want to see my property conserved so much that I'm willing to also make a donation to help you guys do it. And so it's a mixed bag, but really fundamentally it's philanthropy and it's support from people who really care about seeing this happen.
Will you speak briefly to the benefits and the work that you're doing with community gardens?
Yeah. As I said earlier, we've been doing community gardens for a long time. In fact, when Mayor Giuliani tried to sell off 100 and some odd community gardens in New York City 10 years ago, a boneheaded move, these had been colonized by local neighbors, and they were wonderful little mini parks in neighborhoods that didn't otherwise have parks. But he got it into his head that it was an asset and needed to be sold, and so we ended up, should have been transferred with a stroke of the pen to the City Parks Department. But we got involved and essentially raised the money and bought those gardens and then turned them back over to the gardeners. So we've been involved in this work for a long time. I think the real benefit, and I differentiate between urban agriculture and community gardens. And people in community gardens are growing food. Urban agriculture tends to be a little bit more intense and is, more involved in food production and very few owners. But between community gardens and urban agriculture, I don't think we're going to be able to certainly solve our urban food needs. But for kids that don't know where their food comes from, and so many of them don't, they think it comes from the supermarket, for them to be able to go and actually see food growing. And there was just an article, I think, on NPR the other day about an orchard in a public park somewhere in the Central Valley that I heard. And so it's like a fruit forest. To be actually have our public land available to some extent as demonstrations for what food looks like, where it comes from, I think is enormously powerful. So I think there's an opportunity to do a lot more of that. And then I also think in this economic downturn, when there's so much vacant land, and just go to Detroit, go to Cleveland, there's a lot of land there that could be turned over to urban agriculture where the soil can actually be used. And so I think there's some really interesting opportunities in a few cities at a larger scale, but generally we don't have the land base to make it work. I don't know if I answered your question.
Just remind our audience that we're listening to Will Rogers speak on the value of public parks, and there's time for just another couple of questions. So, thanks.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about parks in the city. My question is about ecology and eco-literacy. And it was acknowledged earlier tonight that we're now an urban species worldwide. And, of course, we need nature. But it also seems like there's an urbanite assumption that nature doesn't exist in cities. So regarding things like Park Score and some of the work that you're doing across the country, where do you see biodiversity as a metric, and also eco-literacy as a metric, and also civic identity rooted in local nature as a metric of the urban world as an ecosystem? It seems like the future of the planet and our species both depends on our seeing ourselves in relationship to nature and seeing ourselves in systems. So if you could speak a little bit to the...
Yeah, I don't know how I would begin to come up with metrics for any of those, but they're all critically important. And when we think about the work that we do in cities, we think about parks and playgrounds and gardens and trails that are, to some extent, artificial creations in the way that Central Park is an artificial creation. But they're also remnant pieces of ecosystems in our cities, which are really exciting. Creeks are getting daylighted. There are remnant forests. There are wetlands. You look at the San Francisco Bay. There are pieces of that if they aren't still intact, can be restored. We bought the old Howard Hughes property in Los Angeles, right near Los Angeles Airport, about 500 acres that was, essentially a degraded wetland. But it's, boy, are the birds back. And so I think it isn't just getting out into nature and recreating. It's also understanding nature, which I think is your point. And I think if you don't have those pieces of you know, and that's why a lot of these organizations like Chicago Wild that are popping up around the country that are really embracing the wilderness in the city, either manufactured or real, are incredibly important as part of the overall educational piece of it. And yeah, I don't know how you develop a metric around that, but it's an integral part of the formula.
Yeah, and if you do start measuring it, it might influence how cities are conducting themselves, just to throw that out.
Yeah. Great point.
Hi, this is kind of back to the diversity, the density question we were talking about. Living in dense urban areas, we need more parks, but what about density within the parks? Specifically, how do you balance the needs of different park users, and even more specifically, dogs? Because
I thought I would get through the hour without dog parks.
No, I'm just curious. I have a dog. Yeah, I love to walk my dog outside, and I think that in some ways dogs can be really destructive to wildlife and landscape. But at the same time, I've also seen situations where there were really scary parks that nobody was using. And when dog people started coming, responsible dog owners started mm-hmm. coming to the parks, then the parks became better places for everyone. So do you have any specific examples of success stories there?
Well, so a couple of things. First of all, dogs can also be destructive to shoes. We have a puppy right now. I guess my answer to that, being a dog owner, but also seeing the challenges that exist with dog use of parks, there are a number. Prospect Park in Brooklyn, they have hours during the day when dogs can be in the park off leash, and it's sort of early in the morning and in the evening, and that's they sort of manage the use of the different populations of the park. I think my simplest response would be there's simply not enough parks. Because we need dog parks, and I think, hey, dogs love hanging with dogs, and so it's we go to Point Isabel, which has got to be one of the prettiest dog parks in the whole world, and so I think part of the challenge is we just haven't given enough land over to parks and open space so that there's actually an opportunity to have dog parks where dogs can go, that isn't at the expense of other users, but it is. It tends to be a real issue, and we tend not to get caught in the middle. We like municipalities to solve those problems themselves.
If it's one thing you can count on, though, if we move forward as a species, the dogs will be coming with us. One last question.
You spoke about the three kind of types of parks, and there's the kind of historical Olmstedian, the signature parks, and then you talked about kind of the system-wide parks. I'm wondering if you see a fourth a park, and it's a parks that are resilient, and they kind of operate in an ecological and environmental way. But they're also closely associated with density and how you see a path forward for possibly this fourth park that helps us with Katrina-like things or sandy things. But the problem with those is that they would need to be focused in areas of high density and where change is technically harder to do because of the funding mechanisms. And wondering if you see a future for that.
I guess I'd ask that one back to you, and what about having that be an overlay to the other three kinds of parks? Because I think that kind of resiliency is something that you can build into, whether it's the system or a signature park, or certainly aspects of Olmstedian parks are very much that way as well. And I think that's probably a fundamental principle that ought to be there.
And I think all of our parks are a very good sign of our own resilience as a species. So. Thank you very much, Will, for a great talk. Now another event at the Commonwealth Club of California in its 110th year of enlightened discussion has come to an end. Thank you very much for coming.